My whole childhood was one of running and fear. My name is Jonathan James Newman. I am the son of James Newman, who lives, and Jane Newman, who does not.
My wife is dead and my 2-year-old son is missing.
It's still the weirdest thing I've ever seen in 33 years.
This song is dedicated in loving memory to my sister, Jane Ellen. In the early evening hours.
I mean, I looked up to her very much.
Is the death of Jane Newman a homicide?
And we were best friends.
I believe it is a suicide.
It was a suicide.
I lost my daughter. What else is there?
Her family remembers Jane Newman for her spirit and for the way she lived.
I knew the positive side of Jane that everybody else knows.
A really nice, kind, gentle, generous person.
And I knew the negative side that very few people know.
Jane heard voices.
The folks in her hometown of Hudson, Wisconsin, remember Jane Newman mainly for the way she died.
There's no hair, no skin tissue, nothing else under those fingernails. Absolutely no sign of a physical struggle.
Why was that hole in the wall?
Investigation said no evidence of a homicide.
My sister would never blow her face off.
Very unusual.
On November 22nd, 1993, my mother Jane was killed. Her death certificate claims that the cause of death was homicide. My father destroyed the crime scene upon finding her dead in the basement of our home at the alleged time that he already assumed she was dead before even knowing or having a reason to assume so. He disposed of the weapon, he broke down the door, he burned her suicide note that allegedly existed, he got rid of her dog, and he concocted a story that involved a bomb, a secret government organization, potentially a man with a knife, and of course, a mysterious shotgun. According to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, which we will reference heavily in this video, James Newman confessed that he intentionally altered the scene. My dad said on different occasions that there had actually been a bomb in the house the day that Jane died. He said that when he arrived home, he believed that there was a bomb connected to the door, and that he disarmed that bomb and then found Jane dead in the basement, and there was no gun. He admitted that he had made up the entire story of the bomb. My life started with this death, and throughout it, death has been a recurring theme. I've seen brief moments of sadness in my father's mysterious and quiet life, and I've learned that there are moments that he feels, and there are moments he does not feel. And the moments that he has chosen to not show feeling are the moments that I'm concerned about the most. Now he's an old man. He's a man who has touched the blood of another in order to corrupt a scene. And I've seen these hands. I've seen him work. And he's fed me. He's educated me. He's molded me with these hands. And this blood that he would say I am a victim of, just as he is the blood of my mother. Now, the record notes that after Jane's death, investigators found my dad's explanations contradictory, and his actions were inconsistent with those of an innocent discoverer of a crime. The blood of my mother, whether my dad is innocent or guilty, will be the blood that he drowns in. And if his story is true, I admit that perhaps his only sin is that he never stopped the hemorrhaging of his loved ones before there was nothing left to save, because he has failed to lay down his life for his own kin. As his son, I too have skeletons in the closet as a human being. I'm not here to point out his sins. God is going to judge him the same way he judges me. It's not my place to dig his grave or to protect his honor at this point in my life. I don't wish him or his family any harm or punishment. But considering that he has consistently lied and used his selective memory against me, I've grown tired of hiding my own memories and the stories that he has always kept under wraps or told in very specific ways that benefited him. In case he's listening, which no doubt he is, Dad, if you had not lied so blatantly to me earlier this year regarding this topic and others adjacent to it, when I called you on the phone, and if you had not responded so egregiously toward the things I told you, this testament would have never manifested. But I feel that I have laughed at the things you've put me through for long enough. No longer will you forcing me to witness disgusting things in my childhood be the comical adventures spoken of around your dining room table, like I'm some kind of Tom Sawyer or Huckleberry Finn. No longer will my challenging of the way you raised me be your valid reason to ruin a family gathering with your temper. And no longer will I pretend that I don't see through you when you speak empty words and blatantly lie about literally everything, including how you met your own second wife. You've known where I am this past year, and you chose to treat me as nothing more than some kind of expendable decoration for your family events. Nothing more. I want you to know that this is not revenge. It's just me, your son, finally talking about his upbringing without you there to coat it in sugar or tell me I'm wrong or punctuate it with your little chuckles. And if this angers you, then you should look internally and ask yourself why your son talking about his upbringing and how you've made him feel and what you've subjected him to causes such a reaction to rise up within you. Such a reaction as I witnessed on the phone with you these months ago. This story is my story. It's not his. He's just a character in this version of the tale. To the whole world, and for my entire life, it has been the other way around. Forever, people have come to me with the story, or whispered it around me, having heard it on their own from other sources. They've gone to my siblings, they've gone to my friends. Up to this point, I've been talked about like I'm some kind of cryptid amongst these people. But as the people who don't know me continue to ask the question, where is Jonathan today? I do feel like it is finally time for me to answer. According to official filings summarized in a state of Newman versus Newman, after his confession of scene alteration and evidence destruction, James Newman was arrested in St. Croix County for obstruction of justice. Though he was never charged with homicide, and that should be made clear. The civil jury later determined Jane Newman's death, my mother's death, to be a wrongful death for which he was liable.
Jane Newman lived in this house with her husband, Jim, and their 2-year-old son, Jonathan.
We thought he and Jane were just about the perfect couple.
We were really inseparable, except for when we were at work.
But on a cold November day, Jane and Jim Newman's perfect life came to an end.
It was a day like any other day.
As usual, Jane got up early to go to her job at a mortgage company.
She would usually get ready, get dressed, kiss me goodbye, and take off about 6:30, which is what she did that morning also. And then I would get up, get Jonathan ready, bring him to daycare, and go to work.
And ever since this moment, my dad has encouraged me to hide myself from the government, hide myself from the law, and from the public eye in general. Ever since this moment, he has fled from place to place and made up story after story for why my life has been anything but normal. In his old age, perhaps the silent villain thinks that he's safe from his sins, as he gloriously proclaims the death of those that he would call his enemies from his $500,000 house on the river. I can watch him through a telescope. He is on one side of the river, and I am on the other, both literally and now metaphorically. This is a time of reflection and honesty. And before we really get going and begin, it should be known that I'm not seeking vengeance, and I'm not even expecting justice. Too much time has passed. Vengeance is the Lord's, and justice has long since turned to the soil in which his weeds now grow. This is the time to ask the questions that nobody ever considered asking, and to tell the unimaginable story that spans the early half of my lifetime, the story that others simply cannot believe when they hear it. Once the world bears witness to my story, we will be able to revisit the alleged crime that kicked this calamitous train wreck off.
Things were not right. When Jim got home that evening, he found his wife's body in the basement, dead of a shotgun blast to the head.
911.
My wife is dead and my 2-year-old son is missing.
I've spent, 3.5 years trying to forget what I saw that night.
Do you want an ambulance sent out there? Okay. What do you think that she passed away from?
Her whole head is gone.
So a white female lying on her back.
Even Earl Clark, 33 years in the sheriff's department.
Tremendous trauma to the head.
Was shaken by what he'd found.
Body fluids on the carpeting, also on the wall where her feet were pointed towards. Body matter, including her teeth, in various locations in the room.
Clark interviewed Newman that night, and Newman told him
that he came home, went and hollered her name. She didn't answer. Went to the lower part of the house, found her, and then went and called 911.
Does this look like it's self-inflicted?
Well, there's no gun or anything.
A family friend notified the Johnstons.
He said, Jane's been shot. And I said, how is she? And he said, she's dead.
It was obvious that Jane Newman was standing close to that wall. Why was that hole in the wall? That had something to do with it.
The autopsy report stirred up even more suspicion. It showed that the gun had been inside Jane Newman's mouth when it was fired.
We called him in and said, your story doesn't match.
2 days after Jane's death, Clark interviewed Jim Newman a second time.
It doesn't match the scene. It doesn't match the autopsy. There's more here.
This time, Jim Newman told police he knew who killed Jane.
He broke down and actually cried, actually said, I'm going to tell you the truth.
The truth, Jim said, was that Jane Newman killed herself, and that what he came home to was not, after all, the scene of a murder, but of a bizarre suicide.
When I entered the house, I could smell gunpowder.
Then what happened?
I could see the light was on underneath the laundry room door, and I went to the laundry room door and opened it, and there was a shotgun on the floor and fishing wire attached to it.
A piece of fishing wire, he said, was tied to the trigger.
I could see a hole in the wall, and I immediately went around to the other side of the hole, and I found Jane. And it was obvious that, she was dead.
James Newman, in his second interview, on November 24th in 1993 before the court, said, "I walked into the house and thought I could smell a faint odor of gunpowder. I opened the laundry room door and saw a gun lying on the floor. I saw my wife, saw the wound to her head, touched her, called her name. I saw what appeared to be a note lying on the floor. I picked it up and read it. 'Jane,' he said, 'you're not going to have died this way. I'm not going to let your family and the world know how this happened.' I made a conscious effort to change the scene. I took the gun, found a plastic bag, and slipped a bag over each end of the gun, threw some screws and bolts because I thought I was going to destroy it. I got in the car to leave. Then I decided to break open the front door to make it look like a break-in. I ran up, put my shoulder to the door, broke the doorway from the jamb, got back in the car, and threw the gun in the St. Croix River off the Hudson Bridge. Regarding the alleged suicide note, he said, for some reason I thought the furnace kicked on. It gave me the idea there's an open flame. I'm going to burn it. I put the note underneath the furnace, caught it on fire, and pulled it back out and let it burn up on the cement floor. I brushed the ashes under a towel, folded it up, and flushed it down the toilet. Then I called 911. When you understand the players, you, the listener of this legend, can formulate your own opinions about what actually happened. My whole life growing up, I had these terrible nightmares that persist to this day, but not in the same way and not with the same characters. But in the early days of my life, a cat would come to me, and this feline would deceive me as being a beloved pet, of course, a creature of companionship. But quickly, the dream would spiral as the cat began to possess human-like qualities. It would turn into this sort of half-human form, and she would grow 3 times her size, not really the full size of a human being, but still larger than a cat, and she would chase me through the house. She would chase me through the forest, through the barn, through dark tunnels, until at last she would catch me, and then she would tear me to pieces. As time progressed, but still, while I was a child, the cat would turn into a full-blown human. The cat began to possess qualities that I recognized in the mother that I never knew, but had seen a couple pictures of. And these features began to look like my mother, Jane. And in these nightmares, it was my mother herself who would pursue me in order to kill and possibly consume me. These moments of captivation, I had no idea what the intention was beyond my utter destruction at her hands. My dad allegedly asked both of Jane's parents whether they knew that she heard voices. My grandparents on her side, they said they had never heard any stories of her hearing voices in her head. And so my dad himself was allowed to testify that in 1987, he became aware that Jane heard voices. He said that Jane believed the voices were real, and he stated to the court that the voices came and went, and that he and Jane had discussed them within months of her death. He testified that Jane told him that these were scary voices that were telling her to do things that were disgusting, and he said she was very scared of them. She thought they were going to make her go to hell, he said. Now, no doubt these dreams that I had experienced were born from this indoctrination that I had already begun to absorb from my father. The words that he would tell me were taking root within my tiny baby mind. He had told me stories of how the voices would come to Jane, even as a young boy, a little person. And he said that these voices would whisper to her that she must do abhorrent things for them. The voices, he said, told her that she must kill her only son, and that she must take me away from my slumber and eliminate me from existence. It's described that in the months preceding Jane's death, in these court documents, my dad told co-workers and acquaintances that Jane was hearing voices and might harm herself or others. Investigators found these statements inconsistent with the physical evidence and with the accounts of Jane's family, who said that she had appeared upbeat and even made plans for the coming holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas. Surely it is not hard to imagine how telling these fables of a murderous mother who sought the death of her infant son to that very son might have lasting impacts on his young and growing mind. So, it's not hard to see how my garden was first corrupted with these weeds, sown by a gardener who would only desire one single result: a festering and invasive crop of mistrust in the one who bore me. He said, "No, I did not kill my wife. I did not have her killed or know who killed her. That's all I know. All I did was clean up a mess. I didn't kill Jane. I only kept people from seeing what she did to herself." He said, "I parked in the driveway, but then I backed the car up, then changed my mind and pulled it out into the road. I wanted it to look like I'd just arrived. I took the gun, found a plastic bag, and slipped another over each end of the gun. I got in the car to leave, then I decided to break open the front door. I threw it off the Hudson Bridge into the St. Croix River. It probably sank right away. In another world, my mother was a saint. Indeed, she lived on in the minds of a side of the family, my family, that I never knew, and she lived in their minds as a miracle, a wonder, a beautiful person. But I was the stolen child, and in mine, she became a monster sculpted by not only grief, but God alike, because my whole life I was taught that it was God's plan to flee from them and from her in the way that we did. My father had taken this tragic machinery of love and he had twisted it into a horror story. Her family fought tooth and nail to rescue me from this oblivion, and yet my dad, through a masterful display of the art of escape and lies, whisked me away into the wilderness, quite literally, away from her, away from them, away from civilization, away from life, away, away, away from all the things that he always had a reason for running from. My entire life from that moment on was lived in the forest. To say that I'm a country boy, though, would be a little bit too shallow, because it implies that a certain amount of farming or ranching or something like that was done. But there was no farming, nothing real, there was no real ranching. We did have animals, though. And sadly, like man, all animals must die. But the animals that I came to call friends, the animals that I was raised with, did not die in the way that a beloved pet would die. And it reminds me of the stories of serial killers and how they have no regard for animal life. From a young age, my father taught me to kill animals brutally, not raise them. I did raise a young calf from a suckling, which I bottle fed to maturity, but that calf even would become meat for our freezer. It was funny at the time, We named him Yummy. This was a one-time occurrence, but it did hurt me. And the dogs that he would give me as gifts would be subsequently, potentially, poisoned, run over, or killed in other mysterious ways while I was not around. If they were not killed, they would live with us for a brief moment before being given away, or...
Just weeks before Jane died, Jim Newman brought their dog, Molly, to the animal shelter.
Where it says reason for disposing of dog or bringing the dog in, he says owner passed away. This is weeks before Jane died.
Time and time again, he displayed the characteristic of someone who was completely and utterly unsympathetic to the animal kingdom. I watched him drown baby birds in gasoline upon accidentally knocking their nest from a perch. I wondered how that could possibly even be the best course of action. Even as a child, it felt wrong. As an adult, obviously now I wonder why he allowed me to even witness or know such a thing occurred at all. Another death of an animal friend that also struck me as horrifying and bizarre was the death of a golden retriever. He was a dog that belonged to my father's cult, although he will say it's not a cult, leader, Gary Naylor. And I woke one day and walked past the coffin that my father stored open and welcoming in the basement that I slept in, that's a tale for another time, to the door that would lead outside. And it was my job to care for the chickens. This was the closest thing to farming that we ever did. So on my way to the chicken coop, I found this animal friend dead immediately outside the door. He had suffered what appeared to be massive hemorrhaging from both the anus and the mouth simultaneously. I have no proof that my dad poisoned this animal. I have no reason to believe necessarily. But veterinary toxicology indicates that such simultaneous bleeding is typically symptomatic of poisoning by anticoagulants or organophosphates rather than disease. The dog was generally regarded as not really our pet, as Gary Naylor's pet, and kind of a burden. This was not the only dog we had that died in a weird way. I had never seen so much blood in my life up to this point. It was a pool. The dog's internal organs appeared to have been absolutely obliterated, and now he simply lay stiff and lifeless in that pool of blood right outside the door that I went in and out of every single day. Perhaps the most traumatic event was when he forced me to hold the flashlight in the dead of night as he beat a raccoon to death with a 2x4. Over and over, he beat this animal as it had no other option but to reach out its hands from this position up in the rafters of the barn. Earlier, yeah, this little guy was no doubt trying to get into the chicken coop to get some eggs, maybe a chicken itself. But now, he was being beaten by a piece of wood by an animal far more evil than him. As I shied away, trying not to watch as my dad crushed his face over and over with a piece of wood, blood spattering against the walls, me watching his face become nothing, it took a very long time. It took many blows. My dad would yell at me to hold the light better, to point it at the raccoon because he couldn't see where he was hitting it. I tried to do it without watching, with my eyes closed, as the horror unfolded before me. I was a little kid. I wondered why we couldn't just shoot it. I wondered why we couldn't just scare it away, knock it down. Maybe it would run into the woods. But instead, through small glances, I watched as the raccoon's face became nothing but a distorted mess of blood and gore. And it traumatized me at that moment. And obviously, I remember it even to this day. I'm not one to claim traumas, like some other members of my family do, but psychological studies do link childhood exposure to animal cruelty by their own caregivers to long-term trauma and complex PTSD. Many more animals died due to his absolute negligence throughout my life. He was not careful with life of any kind. I never saw any sadness or remorse from him during these killings or these deaths. He never came to me and comforted me afterward, telling me why he had to do it the way that he did it. Even as he ran over the first dog that I ever had, Scout, perhaps just an honest accident, he brought my friend back to me in the bed of a truck, still warm and with blood gushing from his nose and mouth, because he wanted me to see it. Even though I had no business looking at such a sight with my young eyes. Other fathers would have comforted me about the loss, but they would not have made me see the fatality in that way. I would never do this to my son. I will also never forget the time our family horse died in the pastures, and we assumed it was because hornets had gone up its nose as it grazed. And when this happened, it caused the horse to panic, as you might imagine. It caused it to run hysterically and eventually fall and break its neck because the pastures were very hilly and there was lots of potholes and rocks. So it was a surprising death to me and everyone. But my father's response was even more surprising. He left it where it lay for a few days as he kind of pondered how to get rid of it. And I remember this conversation. I distinctly remember discussions of perhaps digging a giant hole to bury it in, but how long would that take and how much work would it be? Then the concept of perhaps renting a machine to help with that effort, renting it for maybe a few hours. Little bits of conversation that I'm remembering, something like that. And then it would be much easier to bury the horse. But what he actually ended up deciding was that I should collect firewood, and using that wood and diesel that he provided for me, over the course of 3 days, he wanted me to burn the horse's body to ash until even the bones were gone. I was a young man at this point, somewhere in my early teens, but I still remember the smell of flesh and fuel mingling. The black smoke. What a strange thing to make a child do. When you really think about it. In your childhood, have any of you ever had to burn a horse's corpse to ash? And yet, he would still, and still does, attempt to validate this while keeping me from watching movies, listening to music, or playing video games. Because those things were far too evil and violent and sinful. And yet here I was, watching as our horse's blood boiled, his organs popped, and his skin burned. I still have that horse's skull hanging on my wall today. Here I was, rendering yet another animal part of the family, nothing more than dirt and ash in some kind of weird and bizarre method that he thought up. Now, by this point, I'm not sure there was any part of me that even shied away from this. I was already used to this kind of scenery. But it would only be a few years later that I would enlist in the army, comfortable enough with the concept of death, that I didn't fear dying and even wanted it myself. But not all of his strange actions and his nonsensical commands had to do with dead and dying things. He also liked his traps, and he liked his tricks. He likes his robots and his gadgets and his manipulations of reality. A common theme throughout my life was his goblin-like behavior of watching me from the shadows. Not just me, but my other siblings as well. He would stalk us in the forest when we were playing. He would bug my computers and devices as a teenager. He would appear in digital and physical landscapes in the form of creatures and monsters and strangers. And if he wasn't discovered, he would just deny that any of this was ever taking place. But if he was, he would laugh. He would think it's funny. He would harvest our actions from unknown locations and use them against us. Perhaps just playful fatherly games, but the understanding that we were always being watched became ingrained in the minds of not only me, but all of his children. This was a hunting. And sure, it was fun for a time. This was what we found to be fun as children. Sometimes it was like a simple game of Marco Polo to hear him call out strange sounds in the unknown, whether it's the darkness or from behind a corner of the house. Maybe he would shut all the lights off in the house and then he would start playing his little game as we tried to find him or escape from him. But that fun, at some point, turned into something scarier, something with more risk and weight of consequence. He became a silent watcher type who could not be trusted to allow a young man to grow and be himself naturally. At times, I've had to remind him, even as a young adult, not to follow me. Don't hunt me. Don't try to scare me in the woods. Don't try to figure out where I'm going. Because now I carry a weapon, and I would see it as a sign of aggression, and I might not even know that it's him, because if anybody else were to do it to me, I would certainly see it as somebody trying to get the better of me somehow. In court, he said that when Jane called the second time, because he called her a number of times on the day that she died, this was approximately 3:30 p.m., she said that she had arrived home and that the garage door was not working correctly.
That afternoon, when Jane got home from work, she called Jim at the office and mentioned a problem with the garage door.
I asked her to go back out and test the garage door so that she could try to explain to me what it was doing, but she never called back.
Jim tried calling her repeatedly.
I had a heart palpitation or something, and I just felt uncomfortable that she hadn't called back, and I didn't think things were perfectly right.
She also said that she had found another door to the house left open. My dad said that he told Jane to try the garage door a few more times and then to call him back so he could try to determine what might be wrong. He said that because his wife did not call him back, he called the home himself numerous times, where he said he could hear things because of the answering machine they had. If she didn't pick up, he could observe what was going on in the house via the audio. He could listen in on what was happening, and he was trying to hear any sounds. My dad said that after work, he drove his boss home, and then he continued to his own home. And then he said as he entered the home and called for Jane, she didn't answer. He assumed she was maybe shopping with her sister. He said that then he went back out and tried the garage door a few times before Jane, because Jane had complained that the door wasn't working correctly. He then went back into the house and decided to watch some TV. And when he entered the family room, which had the television in it, he found her body. He said that he approached my mother's body, touched her with his toe, and concluded that yes, she was dead. He said he checked briefly for me and didn't find me, and then he called the police. In the same way that he would scurry from place to place in play, he did so for his own survival. For years, the list of addresses we lived at grew. and I can only assume now that it was not because God spoke to him that we moved every couple of years, every year or two, or if we're lucky, three or four. It was because he was running from something. Perhaps from many things, perhaps from many different people. After all, he had been found liable for her death, not necessarily guilty of her death, but at a minimum liable in court. To the world, he had gotten away with murder. And the expiration date, he's always kind of proclaimed, has not yet made itself known. Civil records show that he was found legally liable for Jane's death in 2001. So year after year after year, he moved his family from house to house, from state to state, from home to abandoned shed, from reality to even darker reality. I was homeschooled so that he could keep me out of the eyes of civilization and so as not to expose his whereabouts. And also because obviously the school system sucks. But he also knew that his name was very recognizable in these days. Court filings and media coverage do confirm a pattern of relocation between 1994 and up to this date. There were residences recorded in Wisconsin, Minnesota, Missouri, Washington. Each move coincided with renewed public attention to his case. I never had friends that were not also strange forest creatures or other entities of bizarre society, more akin to a cult than a real life. Some of these people allegedly had cyanide pills for their entire family. Some of these people now live in Africa where they have a new cult of their own. Even among these communities and subhuman societies, he was viewed as a dangerous man, though. The places he worked at would continually discover who he really was, and they would subsequently fire him. Journalists, investigators, and justice seekers of all types would constantly hunt him down. They would send letters. They would appear on our doorsteps randomly. They would threaten him with the full force of the law or with a vindictive justice of their own. It was as if there was a bounty on his head and the whole world wanted to collect it. So we would continue to run. We would continue to move. And each time, "Dad, why are we moving again? I like it here." "Because God told me to." Despite this, he would swear up and down that we were running because God told him to. And who am I to say that God did not tell him to? God does work in mysterious ways, but as I got older, that excuse began to develop pores. You can't simply use God as your excuse for everything. And I could see through the words that he was saying as if they were like water, murky, distorted, yes. But there was something else beneath the surface. In court, it was said that there were things about the scene that didn't fit the story that was given up until that point. The story being that some intruder had come in, surprised Mrs. Newman, my mom, and killed her. It was explained that it was obvious that when Jane died, she was facing and close to one of the walls. There were blood splatters on the wall. It was said that in the laundry room on the other side of the wall, the officers found a hole in the plasterboard and paneling that allowed one to see into the family room where she died. It was testified that after reviewing autopsy reports confirming Jane's death had been caused by a gun, law enforcement reached the tentative opinion that somehow the gun had been inserted through the larger hole in the wall so that the barrel extended into the family room. It was said that within 2 days of Jane's death, law enforcement believed that her death was either an assisted suicide or possibly a suicide with an altered death scene. So my dad once again met with investigators on November 24th. It was said that he walked into the house and he thought he could smell a faint odor of gunpowder. He said he got scared. He looked straight ahead and saw that the laundry room door was closed, but he could see a light on under the door. And he said that he opened that door and that he could smell a stronger odor of gunpowder. And then he saw a gun lying on the floor. He stated that then he ran out, ran into the TV room, saw his wife, saw the wound to her head. He touched her with his foot and he called her name. And he said at that time that he saw what appeared to be a note of some type lying on the floor. So he picked it up and he read it. And he said at that time he made a determination that, Jane, you're not going to have died this way. I'm not going to let your family and the world know this happened. And at that time is when he made a conscious effort to change the scene. As we've said, he said the first thing he did was take the gun, found a plastic bag, slipped it over each end of the gun. He advised that it was a break-open type shotgun, that he looked and he saw a shell in the chamber. He closed the gun again. After putting the gun in the bags, he threw in some screws and bolts and other items because he knew, or at least thought, he was going to destroy it by putting it in the water. He then took the gun out and put it on the floor of the back seat of his car. He got in the car to leave and then suddenly got the idea, wait a second, I'm going to break open the front door. And this would add to this story and make it look like a break-in. He got out of his car, he ran up, put his shoulder to the front door, and he broke it from the doorway. Then he got back in the car, and he made the intention of putting the gun in the Willow River. For some reason, he decided that that river wasn't deep enough. So he changed his mind and went to the St. Croix River, and threw it in the St. Croix River. He later told police, and ultimately testified at trial, that there appeared to be a fishing line attached to the gun and leading to the wall, but no fishing line was ever recovered. With this information, law enforcement theorized that Jane must have tied some type of monofilament line to the trigger, wrapped it around the butt of the gun, passed the line through the hole in the wall, and when she was positioned with the gun in her mouth, she pulled on the fishing line, discharging the gun into her head. In addition to testimony that her demeanor in the days before her death seemed inconsistent with somebody who would commit suicide, several witnesses testified that if she were to commit suicide, she would not have done it this way. She wouldn't have done it with a gun, some kind of elaborate method of firing the gun through a wall. She would have had to put multiple holes through the wall, and she did all of this in a single try without failing at all. Jane's brother Charles and her mother Patricia testified that Jane wasn't comfortable around guns or mechanically inclined. Charles, her brother, testified that in my entire lifetime, I do not remember Jane ever touching a gun, ever, which is kind of unique when you think of the number of guns that we actually had in our house, because her side of the family was indeed a hunting family. Additionally, though, it is undisputed that my dad did not have any guns in their house. So, Jane would have had to acquire a gun and shells in order to commit suicide in this manner. She would have had to have done so on her own. Ultimately, though, no evidence was ever presented that Jane acquired a gun or shells, on her own or otherwise. Now, after a while, and at some ambiguous time in my childhood that I don't really recall, I just remember things changing, my dad began to shift his tone. He made it known to me that we were indeed running, though this was not before he tried and failed to move us to a completely different continent, to Africa. To me, it's kind of coincidental that now his past, not cult, but definitely cult leader, Gary Naylor, is in Africa with his own commune. this religious companion around these times and the leader of the cult adjacent group that he helped form, is the one who lives in Africa to this day with his cult of brides. He has a whole commune there that he's built, that they built for him, his followers. But he can't even speak their language. And I can only imagine that this was my father's dream as well, that we would disappear on another continent where no one would go, never to be seen again. I'm not saying it's another Jonestown type incident, but I mean, it's kind of weird. Maybe we would all die there. And this would still be a better end than what was in store for him, potentially, in the United States. This is all speculation, but by this point, surely you can understand why I entertain it. It's all very bizarre, because at the time, the idea was that this was some kind of mission trip, and I found that totally bizarre and uncharacteristic because we never even went to church. He had his own set of beliefs at this time that he repeatedly claimed did not even align with any church. He said the church was the false bride of Christ. He declared the church some kind of evil abomination to never be a part of. I still remember him peeling the Christian symbol of the fish off of his white Monte Carlo, and I asked him, what, we're just not Christians anymore? Again, a child. And he replied that we were not Christians. We were a different type of believer. He then sold everything we had in a kind of last-ditch effort to attach himself to this religious organization, all of a sudden, in order to whisk us away to Africa. But they found him out. And that's how he described it. They found out what I believe, he said at the time. His petition to go to Africa by this group was rejected. So now, having no home, because he sold our house before even solidifying this plan, we were forced to live in an abandoned building on the side of a highway across from the house that we had just sold. All I had to do was walk across the highway, which was like a county highway, so a two-lane state road more than anything, and I could be on the property that we had just lived on. But now I was in this abandoned shed-like building on the other side of the highway, looking over at my home. Through that property was the creek that I was baptized in. He baptized me himself there. Now I wasn't even allowed to go on the property, just observe it from this abandoned building that we lived in. So him, his new wife, and his children, we just made the most of this because this was God's plan. To him, this was a trial, perhaps like Job underwent or something. I don't know. I don't know what his thoughts were at this time. The difference was, though, even Job wept as his family was taken from him, but my father didn't appear to cry in court as he gazed upon the headless body of his wife. He cursed the church, and he used it as one more shred of evidence of how this whole world was against him, especially organized religion. My dad, upon the death of my mom, Jane, became very, very passionate about letting the past die as she did and moving on without her memory. Not only this, but he also ensured that I would move on without her memory as well. If a memory would ever happen to manifest itself in my brain, he would squash it or have some kind of scripted response that he continues to repeat and recite to this day. According to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, after Jane's death, he removed or destroyed numerous items from the home and burned what he claimed was her suicide note. He snickered at her family in court.
I think they need somebody to pay for Jane's death, and I'm the most obvious target.
That tried to provide arguments for why he's the murderer. He smiles at the accusations. He looks like a total lunatic in court as he laughs off what is merely an investigation into her death. something that only he appeared to know anything about.
Can you, in your mind's eye, see her planning this and doing this, propping up a gun, pulling a string, all of this stuff to kill herself? And why would anybody choose that way to kill themselves?
How would you do it?
One has to assume that everything went as planned on the first time.
And he made sure that nobody else would ever know about it as it happened. His own words.
This woman leaves a note, according to James Newman, that I want to be remembered as thin and pretty and happy. And that's the way she's remembered, sir. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Does she look thin, pretty, and happy?
Mr. Garrity, I resent this.
I'm sorry, sir.
The last witness for the defense...
You've heard all the evidence that has been stated here?
Yes.
...is Jim's wife, Heather.
You still believe in your husband?
100%.
You love him?
I love him to death.
He had a new woman 3 months later.
They married the following year.
Ta-ta.
And Jim took a job at Microsoft.
A woman that he convinced to adopt me, as I've been told. The story I understand is that this was because he feared losing custody of me, and rightfully so. Now, considering that my dad developed a script that he has stuck to for his entire life, I might never actually know the fine details of this transaction of my life. But what I do know is that it was not Jane's will that some strange woman would be handed over my existence. She wished for members of her family to seek custody of me in the situation that anything happened to her or my dad. It's called having godparents. And court documents confirm that after Jane's death, her parents, my grandparents on her side, petitioned for custody of me before the case could proceed. But my dad had already arranged for this strange woman, Heather Hess, whom he had recently hired as a caregiver all of a sudden, to adopt me. And that effectively ended my grandparents' custody petition. Jane's parents would no longer get me because of this. And this occurred in 1996. So upon destroying the crime scene in order to make the landscape of my mother's death a mystery, my mother's family sought custody of me. Obviously, they and everybody else on the planet pretty much suspected him to be the murderer and thought Jonathan shouldn't live with them. Shouldn't live with him. After all, he had done literally everything in his power to disguise the true facts of her death. So instead of allowing this to happen, instead of allowing the suicide to be a story in the first place that would have enabled me to continue to be a member of both families, he found another hole to fill and quite literally placed me in it. So not only did he banish her side of the family completely, he and his new project wife went so far as to change my birth certificate so that it no longer had my biological mom's name on it. No longer had Jane's name on it. And if you look at my birth certificate today, it is still a fraudulent document because it has my stepmom's name on it as somebody who birthed me. I don't even know where to begin with that one. It would appear, and it will appear, for the rest of my life, and to anyone who would ever look upon the details of my birth, that I was born of this Frankenstein's monster that he now proclaimed his beloved. He would wipe her, not only from my mind, but also from my legal existence. And at this time, adoption and amended birth certificate procedures in Wisconsin allowed new birth records to be issued listing the adoptive parent in place of a deceased biological parent. That's just the facts. It's unfortunate, but it's the facts. He would issue warnings to Jane's side of the family to never seek contact with him or me again, despite claiming for the TV that he wanted to somehow heal the relationship and that the media was blowing all of the distrust out of proportion. From an alleged murderer, such warning can obviously be seen as kind of dramatic. He would get rid of all of her belongings, except a few that I managed to rescue, and he would warn all of his other children to be cautious of what they hear, saying that anybody can say anything they want online, but of course I'm the one with the truth. And yet, the pictures that were hung on the wall over my mother's dead body he kept for years and years. This was an elimination of not only my mother, but my mother's entire memory. Her very existence and that of her entire family, gone. He wanted it to be as if none of this had ever happened and none of them had ever existed. Even his parents, my grandparents on his side, applauded him as some kind of brave victim of an unjust trial, and they proudly proclaimed on TV that my mother had plenty of reasons to kill herself.
Jane Newman claims he knew another Jane.
I knew the positive side of Jane that everybody else knows, and I knew the negative side that very few people know.
A Jane who lived in a secret world of depression, bulimia, and insecurity, a world she hid from everyone.
Nobody understands the full reason why somebody commits suicide. But if you're looking for reasons, she had a dozen of them.
Jim's parents, George and Evie Newman.
She was afraid of the world. She was afraid of everything.
Everything.
She was totally insecure.
Have since learned about Jane's problems from their son.
He said every night he would come home from work and she would cry.
There's a lot of things that concerned her enough that she would cry herself to sleep.
And tell him how she felt unloved, how she felt. You know,
her family didn't know any of that.
No,
because
and
Jim
neither
wouldn't tell
we.
Her family about that.
No.
I had spent our whole marriage protecting her reputation from people, protecting the fact that, you know, she spent evenings crying at night and the fact that she was bulimic, so that Jane could go out in the public and have the appearance that everybody knows her as.
In 1997, the Minneapolis St. Paul magazine feature reported that members of the Newman family publicly defended James Newman's innocence and attributed her death to suicide, despite the homicide ruling on her death certificate. What I've come to find out now from communication with the LaCroix Sheriff's Department is that my father knew his new wife's sister even before he knew his new wife. Allegedly, she said that he creeped her out since he couldn't have her, at least according to what I've heard from these police officers. He got her sister instead. She was this young, impressionable, damaged little toy, and he said to her, "Adopt my son." At least if what he told me is true. And then she did. Then he married her. It's a true and beautiful little fairy tale as they describe it, but their little happily ever after is mired with blood and deception. And it should be explicitly stated that this was oral communication between myself and a law enforcement officer that was there, but I can't really back it up in written form. But multiple women came forth during the case and said that my dad was creepy and controlling and behaved very inappropriately, occasionally stalked them or would buy them flowers. And these accounts were recorded in trial exhibits. And Heather, would his new wife, would raise me differently than her new children, which she very quickly birthed for him. Indeed, when my real mother, when Jane's family would come forth again in 2001 to seek justice for me if they couldn't get it for Jane, for my mom, this imposter woman testified that she loved my dad to death. What a strange set of words to say in regard to an alleged killer. It's like just twisting the knife. And that's exactly the type of person she is. The phrase, "I love him to death," appears in her 2001 deposition that was used when describing her loyalty to my dad, despite questioning by opposing counsel about his conduct toward my real mom, Jane. Now, during this trial, he was found liable for my mom's death, for Jane's death, and was issued a judgment. The judgment required him to pay Jane's estate, me, a large sum of money. But he kept this fact hidden for years and years, hidden from me, never once obeying the law and complying with the judgment, at least not according to my understanding. Like any son, once in a while he would send me a few bucks, he would help me out of a jam. But that's just being fatherly. In September of 1999, my dad moved for summary judgment on any remaining damages or issues pertaining to damages, arguing that because my mom died instantly since her head was blown off, the estate really had no claim for pain and suffering after the gunshot. Now keep in mind, he's already never going to abide by this judgment, but he still wants to make it known, and he still wants to make it clear legally that she didn't suffer. At the same time, he wanted to waive his right to a jury trial on the issues, on the damages issues, because he was afraid of jail. He was afraid that this would cause him to be actually found guilty if the evidence was reviewed again. And then he may actually go to jail. In response, the estate argued that Jane suffered emotional distress in the minutes before she died. The estate then sought to amend the pleadings to add a claim for intentional infliction of emotional distress. The trial court granted the motion to amend the pleadings and denied my dad's motion for summary judgment. St. Croix County judgment records confirm that he was then ordered to pay a minimum of $188,000 plus possibly somewhere around $800,000 to Jane's estate in 2001. I am Jane's estate, and there has been no satisfaction of this judgment ever filed because he kept this hidden from me until the judgment would allegedly expire if it wasn't acted upon. He instead chose a life of brainwashing for me, giving me the stories and lifetime that I have just described for you. Since I was 8 years old and then stolen from the very fabric that was cut for me when this judgment was issued, taken away from my mother's family completely, taken away from any semblance of normalcy, and hidden in the forest, quite literally, there was no way of me ever knowing about this judgment. Because who was going to tell me? Him? So for the rest of my life, he was easily able to hide that judgment from me, and he did so successfully. But he had another trick up his sleeve. I am now an investigator and journalist of my own style. The truth seems quite apparent for why I was raised the way that I was. Time and time again, I have reached out to him asking for written truths or real conversations to look back and remember my mother. Each time, he's gotta prepare. Each time, it's gotta be on his turf, at his time. Each time, the same scripted answers. Never anything new, in spite of any new questions that I might come up with. And they say that the best liars believe their own lies, right? But of course it helps if there is no truth to tell. If ignorance is the lie. Because saying I don't know or I don't remember kind of puts an end to the whole thing. And he, of course, excuses himself from any potentially damning explanations for anything at all. And it should also be known that approximately 1 month after Jane's death, my dad did submit to a polygraph test. The examiner did conclude that he truthfully answered no to six relevant questions. The six relevant questions were, did you physically do anything to cause the death of Jane Newman on November 22nd? On November 22nd, did you shoot Jane? prior to finding her on November 22nd, did you know she was going to commit suicide? Are you now withholding any information about how Jane obtained that gun? Before November 22nd, did you ever see that gun? Are you now lying about how you say you got rid of that gun on November 22nd? The results of the test and evidence that my dad took a polygraph examination were excluded. And the trial court concluded that the test results are not legally and were not legally admissible in Wisconsin, and that even if they were, the specific questions posed in his examination made the results unreliable. So the trial court did not explicitly address his attempt to introduce evidence that he took a polygraph examination. At 18, I did receive some sort of life insurance, if we're going to be transparent here. And this was thanks to my parents' foresight when I was a baby. It was a meager amount compared to what I am owed. And yet, at 18, and despite my father and I being at odds at this time, because another consistent pattern of his is never communicating with his children if he doesn't absolutely have to, he made sure to reach out. And at this time I was in the army, to try to steal that money from me as well. He said, well, let me have half of it. And I said, no. And then he said, well, at least let me hold it for you. I can invest it. And I again said, no. Just like that, he would have played the same game again. And had I not learned to be cautious of his character already, he would have won again. After all, he had already taken the majority of the life insurance policy that was paid out upon Jane's death and used it in his own ways. There was evidence that he had a financial motive to kill my mom. He testified that he and Jane had approximately $45,000 in debt, in addition to their $125,000 mortgage at the time of her death. In the 90-day period before Jane's death, they consulted with a bankruptcy attorney to determine whether to file bankruptcy, but they decided not to file. It is undisputed that my dad collected a $116,000 life insurance policy that had been issued to Jane just over 2 years before her death. Additionally, he testified that the life insurance policy's suicide exclusion expired on November 18th, 1993, 4 days before her death. The jury also heard evidence that suggested he found his wife burdensome. He testified that before her death, he told one of his co-workers, a woman, that Jane was emotionally unstable and needed his caregiving and emotional support constantly. His boss said that my dad told him that he had to do the housekeeping and cooking and take care of his son, Jonathan, and provide emotional support. I'm so sorry you had to go through that, Dad. I'm so sorry you had to do some housekeeping and do some cooking and take care of your son and also love your wife. One of my dad's co-workers who knew my mom testified that the overall impression that I had was not just on one occasion, but on other occasions as well, that Jim was dismissive of his wife. She seemed to be some kind of baggage that he had to carry around. A motive? Perhaps. But only one motive in a plethora of potential others. I knew the imposter wife that he got next was a sick animal when she began to hate me, especially later in life. It was her who once said to me at 17 years old, if you don't enlist in the military, we may send you to military school. So they walked me to the enlistment office and signed me away. Didn't offer me an alternative route. Didn't help me pay for college. Didn't help me develop an alternative plan. Just go be a soldier. That'll get you out of this, and it'll turn you into a man. It was her who once let it slip in the kitchen of the house that they still live in to this day that it may be better if I was dead, years after I returned from the army. It was her who prompted me to approach him and tell him that if she didn't shut her disgusting, hateful, spiteful mouth and start treating me like a human being, that he would never see the faces of his grandchildren. And it was her who flipped on a dime to play the cute little toy housewife at his command, the one that he always wanted. To this day, both the extended family he has and his wife's extended family look at him with weird sideways glances. And it's my belief that truly everyone who has met Jim Newman sees him as a dangerous sign of disease in the panorama of their lives. He is a dying tree in a forest of life. But instead of allowing himself to be cut down for firewood, he would poison the rest of the forest. The reason that I'm coming forth now, after all these years, is simple. Very simple. Despite the fact that he would tell his other children that I am merely pursuing money, that is not the reason for this. Earlier this year, I encountered some photos and videos of my dead mother that I cannot explain, that I could not explain, and I read evidence that I also could not explain, much of which has been provided for you today. Crime scene photos of my mother without a face, blood spattered everywhere, gore, and a scene of violence that was set against a backdrop of what appeared to be a happy life that she looked forward to. A man by the name of Jensen testified that in this case, he reviewed the scene, the photographs of the scene, and the autopsy protocol. He said that he found significant the fact that Jane was wearing her coat at the time of death, and that her purse was placed next to the scene area. She set it down on the couch, directly adjacent to where she would die.
Just hours before she died.
The purse fell off her shoulder. The strap had broken, and she wanted to stop and get a new purse on her way home.
Jane exchanged a purse.
And when she's discovered later, her purse, she had just stopped at TJ Maxx and exchanged, is in the room with her. Her purse is here, she is here, and she has her leather coat on.
Jensen noted that there were indeed two holes in the wall, the larger hole through which everybody just agreed that the gun had been placed in, a smaller hole through which Jensen had been told a monofilament-like fishing line had been placed. It should be noted there were no marks on my mother's fingers from pulling this line. You would expect there to be some kind of small cut or indentation in her fingers from tugging on a fishing line that would trigger a shotgun into her head. Jensen also said that he saw pink bubble wrap material and black electrical tape on the family room floor where she died. The autopsy report indicated that the same materials were recovered from my mother's skull. Jensen testified that Jane was fully dressed in outdoor attire. The purse in the scene would indicate that she came directly to the family room as she entered the home. He said, "I can only describe the setup and the detonation of the weapon as an elaborate setup, in which it would be my opinion that there was some attempt to either obscure the end of the weapon or provide some kind of silencer-type material to the end of the weapon. And the method of detonation of the weapon would be very highly elaborate."
On what Jim Newman says he saw, a theory has evolved as to what it all means. That is, how Jane Newman might have killed herself. The gun, the theory goes, was propped up, poked through a hole in the laundry room wall. A piece of fishing line was wrapped around the trigger and then threaded through a second hole in the wall. On the other side of the wall, the gun stuck through a few inches. It was later discovered to have been wrapped in some sort of plastic wrapping material, fastened with black electrical tape. In any case, the theory is that Jane Newman put the end of the gun in her mouth, grabbed it with her right hand, reached across with her left, and pulled on the fishing line. That's the theory. No one disputes how bizarre it all sounds.
I agree. It's strange.
It's still the weirdest thing I've ever seen in 33 years.
But investigators say it was the only conclusion the evidence supported.
We had a medical examiner that said it was a suicide. We had a sheriff's department investigation that said no evidence of a homicide.
But why would Jane Newman kill herself, especially this way?
I didn't know why the police were saying this, but I couldn't accept that that was the truth.
And why would her husband want the police to think it was murder?
I know that what I did is wrong, but I had no choice. I had to protect her.
In a moment, Jim Newman's incredible story.
I figured that if there was no gun, there would be no suicide, that it would then be a murder.
And what he says really happened that awful night.
I realized I could just burn this note up, then it would be gone too.
He goes on to argue that Newman's version of the next 25 minutes...
That gun I saw in the other room, I'm going to go pack that up.
...is not only bizarre, it is also physically impossible. And to prove it...
This is what we call a jury view.
He takes the jurors for a ride.
There will be no testimony taken.
Retracing the route Jim Newman says he took to get rid of the gun.
This is the former Newman residence. 895.
He took his car all the way out to the interstate bridge.
Okay, everybody ready?
You observe the fence that Jim Newman allegedly jumped.
Observe the height and the nature of this protective fence.
Wearing a trench coat, carrying a gun, doing it with one hand, and proceeding out onto the bridge. And then he threw the gun, ran back to his car, hopped over the fence.
Read the note, burn the note, put the picture, deal with the door. I mean, it sounds almost implausible that you could do all that in that amount of time.
I think that if you were to write down how long everything takes, you'd find out that I had more than enough time.
As for the gun, investigators did search for it.
They dove for approximately 3 to 3.5 hours. They did not locate the weapon.
Logic tells us then, if they've done a diligent search... It's your position that you can't find the gun. Is that right?
And they don't find a gun.
That's correct.
All right.
There isn't a gun there.
It was a trap. It was a trick. It was a proverbial vending machine of death. And all she had to do was pull the line. Did somebody build this for her and merely encourage her to use it? This was my mother, who was preparing for Thanksgiving. She had gotten a fresh manicure. The moments before she died, she had come from the store with this brand new purse. She had just spoken on the phone to her family members, excited about various things in the future, including having another baby. According to the Wisconsin Division of Criminal Investigation, Jane Newman's hands did indeed show fresh nail polish. Shopping bags were recovered and groceries, including Thanksgiving items, that were dated the day before her death. Conversations with her family members about how she was excited for the holidays.
To the family, the idea of Jane committing suicide was beyond shocking.
My sister would never blow her face off. Never.
It was unbelievable.
We were so close to her, there was no reason for her to kill herself. None at all.
In fact, the Jane they knew had every reason to live.
She was very happy. She was excited about having another child.
What are you eating?
There was 2-year-old Johnny, light of her life.
She lived for that child.
Hey, Jen.
And there was Jim, her husband of 6 years, whom she adored.
Jane just thought he was Mr. Wonderful. They seemed to be very happy together.
And those who spoke to Jane in her final hours...
Jane called me the morning that she died.
...say that she was cheerfully making plans for the week ahead.
And we talked about Thanksgiving. It was just 3 days away, and I said, Jane, I'll bring the turkey. And she wanted to know if she had enough cans of sweet potatoes.
What was she like that day?
There wasn't the same as every day. We went on our walk, we talked, we giggled, we went back to work.
Ann King was Jane's closest friend at work and one of the last people to see Jane alive.
I can't imagine her leaving Jonathan here without her. That was her devotion, her husband and her child.
You absolutely cannot accept the possibility that she killed herself.
I want to know why she would kill herself, despite the fact that on the morning of the day she died, she called her mother and discussed plans to have Thanksgiving dinner at her house, at Jane's house, at my dad's house. They talked about the menu and who would cook the turkey. I want to know why her mother, my grandmother, testified that she didn't perceive that anything was even troubling Jane. She said, I'm hearing things about Jane being depressed, and I'd like to know when, if she hid it this well, because I'm not aware of this depression. I want to know why Jane's brother, my uncle, Charles James Johnston, that I never got to meet, testified that he spoke with Jane on the telephone days before her death. They discussed the fact that Jane was going to be reducing her work to spend more time with me. He said that Jane was very excited about this fact, that she was cutting back her hours. He said that she seemed happy that she and her sister were discussing the possibility that her sister might move next door and the two could raise their children together. I want to know why my mom would kill herself after that type of discussion. Jane's boss testified that on the same day, she and Jane talked about whether Jane was eligible for vacation and holiday pay. She said Jane was upbeat and professional and didn't seem stressed at all. I want to know why there was evidence that there may have been a struggle that was presented, in the form of a lampshade in the room where Jane died being tilted obscurely. And the crime scene investigators also found one of my mom's earrings bent and lying on the floor in the corner of a room. Upon cross-examination, why did the sheriff's department acknowledge that a bent metal earring and a tilted lampshade could be evidence of a struggle in this case? Why did Jensen, the man who reviewed the autopsy, testify that in his opinion, it was suspicious that the earring was bent in the way that it was, and that there wasn't any evidence of trauma on the body where the earring was pulled off? I want to know why it was testified that the barrel of the gun that extended into the family room was disguised in a certain way. There was bubble wrap and electrical tape found in Jane's head and on the floor.
Yeah. Me saying I didn't do it is not worth a lot. I'm a liar, remember, the world's best liar. Funny thing is a lot of times, like even when I was talking to our church group about it, they're like, and you didn't do it, right? You know, I mean, they were like, say that, you know? And so it's, I do often leave that out.
You didn't do it. You didn't do it.
I want to know why my dad placed a picture over the hole, but then kept that picture that he placed over the hole. And I want to know why the bubble wrap came from his place of work. There are questions that I just have never received answers to. Maybe you can find them. In the past few years, my dad has happily, excitedly proclaimed the death of members of Jane's family, my grandparents, and also people who worked against him in the case. He happily informed me that his enemies are dying and retiring and disappearing, and he would soon be safe from them. He says it with a grin that makes even my wife cringe, and it has severely caused me to question his state of mind, both now and back then. What kind of God-fearing man cheers at the death of a family member? The story that I've told you has never been told or heard. And there are many places even now that I could have gone into much greater detail. This testament that I present to you could at a minimum be tripled in length, as the court documents themselves are dozens of pages long. I wrote this over the course of a week, changing things that I felt didn't need to be included, including things that I felt should be said. Some things I felt were spoken with too much hate, so I amended those things because it's not my intention to spread hate, but to get truth, but to get honesty. This is not a pity party or me trying to claim something from my father, despite his efforts to say that I am only even talking about my mother's death because I want money, because that is, seems to be, a great representation of his own thoughts. The way that he has spoken to my other family members about my intentions, the way that he lied to me blatantly when I cornered him on this matter earlier this year, and the way that he has not pursued me to try to explain any of it. All of these things are just ways that he has proven to me who he really is. I ask everybody who watches this, come to your own conclusion. I'm not seeking retribution for retribution's sake. I am seeking answers and justice and love from my father that I never received because of this matter. I want to know why he lied. There are many just strange lies he told, revolving a secret organization that he said planted the bomb on the door because they wanted him to do secret work for them and he was refusing. There was once talk of how a man with a knife might have forced her to do this. Come to your own conclusions. I only want the truth, one that doesn't appear to even exist anymore, because everybody who had it has died or is accused of killing it. So if this story touches you or prompts you to come forth with evidence, insight, or pushes you toward any action that you consider worth your energy, then please share this, because this case grows colder every single day, but it's not completely buried yet.
Jim Newman seems likely to stay a free man.
That's the alleged murderer.
The question of his guilt or innocence,
there's Marion Jane,
may never be answered.
And called her mom and dad to say.
Because the only other person who knows the real truth is forever silent.
We will eventually get to the bottom of Jane's death. It may take us our lifetimes, but we will get to the bottom of her death.
Thank you.